This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
Welcome back to our final session of the day, which is our second keynote presentation from Professor Ragnar Lofsted. Ragnar is a Professor of Risk Management at King's College London, where he teaches and conducts research into risk communication and risk management. He's also the Director of the King's Centre for Risk Management. Ragnar's got a very high profile in risk management, both nationally and internationally. He holds positions at Harvard University, Carnegie Mellon University, Gothenburg University as well, and he serves as editor or on the editorial board for a number of leading risk journals. Ragnar's received various awards for his contributions to risk analysis, including the 2006 Outstanding Service Award from the Society for Risk Analysis, to which he was elected a fellow in the previous year. He was invited to lead the Independent Review of Health and Safety Legislation in 2011, and he produced a report that was very well received. So I'm very pleased to welcome you, Ragnar. I look forward to hearing about risk communication in the 21st
century. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here on this wonderful, beautiful day here in Cambridge. And before I start to clarify, I'm not an expert on education the way you guys are talking about. I actually sat in for the last panel discussion. I was hiding up there as a little spy. I was thinking, there's no way I can answer these questions. So don't ask me any teaching education questions or A-levels or GCSEs. All I can tell you, my oldest daughter is going through A-levels right now. And it's rather a stressful period being a father, I must say. So what I'm going to do today is provide a definition of risk perception and communication and put it into context with examples, primarily anecdotal examples, as well as also some serious ones. And if time permits, and I should warn you, I gave this talk in Bonn last week to a bunch of civil preparedness folks, and I only went through 5 slides. We'll see how we go. This is 32 slides here. We don't know what's going to happen. So if time permits, we will also describe how we in Europe have moved from an old consensus model to a new, more transparent, liberative model of regulation, summarize some of the teething problems associated with this new model, describe what may happen with the new model of regulation over a 5 to 10 year period, and finally offer some possible solutions to the teething problems. And I promise basically to organizers, I will offer you some next steps because I have my own personal agenda on this, having now been actively involved in advising this government on risk for my sins, for better or for worse, put it that way. And this is on the record, so I'll be very careful what I need to say here, don't I? So basically, risk perception. One of the key issues, this whole field started by work by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, and they discussed the whole issue of heuristics and biases, so-called mental shortcuts. And they identified a number of very key, very, very important variables. One such thing is the so-called anchoring effect. The anchoring effect occurs when people consider a particular value for an unknown quantity before estimating that quantity. What happens then is that estimate stays close to the number the person initially considered. Now, let me give you a couple of examples of what I mean by that. For example, if you were asked whether Gandhi was more than 114 years of age when he died, then you'll end up with a much higher estimate of his age at the time of death than you would if you asked a question referencing to his death at age 35, right? Similarly, if you look at the work, for example, the BP oil spill in 2010. Remember when that thing happened? The initial estimate from BP was what? It was 1,000 barrels were leaking out of that thing a day. The actual number, as you all know, was 65,000 barrels a day. But BP could not, in their wildest imagination, move from 1,000 to 65,000 because they were anchoring at 1,000. So they think it would be 2,000, 3,000, not 65,000. And that's one of the problems BP had in its communication strategy. Furthermore, I can tell you, you can look at the museums in the States in particular, is that a lot of these folks are aware of folks anchoring. So, for example, if you go to the Boston Museum of Fine Art, and you go there on one Thursday per month, it's free. And if you go in there and you don't see the sign, please give a donation. People give maybe $1 or $2. But if it says basically its anchor suggested donation, $20, I can assure you it's going to be more than $1 or $2, even like $13 or $14 or $15. So the anchoring effect is absolutely crucial. Another important issue is a simplifying heuristic. People use resemblance to make a difficult judgment. And I'm going to give you now an example here. An individual has been described by his neighbor as follows, and I quote, "Steve is a very shy and withdrawn, invariably helpful, but with little interest in people or in the world of reality. A meek and tidy soul, he has a need for order and structure and a passion for detail." And it's now in the States. "Is Steve more likely to be a librarian or a farmer?" Hands up for librarian. All of you are going to say librarian, I promise you on that one. And this is basically work by Daniel Kahneman. And the actual fact is, no, the problem here, now, you know, we ignore statistics. There are 20 times more male farmers than there are librarians. So this guy, all this meek and tidy show and doesn't like people, obviously hangs with cows the whole time, he's going to be a farmer. So very important to standardifying heuristic. Furthermore, it's the availability heuristic. Our judgments are warped by media coverage, the so-called availability of information. When I ask my students at King's College or elsewhere, do we have more homicides or more suicides in the United States? The answer I always get is, oh, Ragnar, that's easy. It's going to be tons more homicides. I mean, every single day on U.S. television, you have 474 deaths. You know, there must be more, much more, many more murders than suicides. But in actual fact, the statistics show there are actually more suicides than homicides. Furthermore, we need to understand base rates. Large samples are much more accurate than small samples. I always talk to pollsters about this. And say, well, basically, these figures look really good. What's a sample size of a low 50? Well, sample sizes of 50 are not really useful. These sample sizes are more like 1,000, and a minimum. And furthermore, you have so-called hindsight bias. This is I know it all along effect. People tend to revise their beliefs in light of what actually happened. So, for example, if you speak to folks across the pond in New York, for example, now post 9/11, they'll say, we totally knew it was going to happen. People are going to go and take these airplanes, use them as rockets, and fly into various skyscrapers in New York. Well, actual fact, no way. If you speak to the FBI or the CIA or these very military people, which I do from time to time, they will tell you we had simply no idea. We were not ready for it. Another example of hindsight bias was the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. If you speak to a lot of folks and conspiracy theorists, well, basically Roosevelt wanted to go into the war. He wanted this to happen. He knew all about it. No, Roosevelt did not know anything about the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So-called hindsight bias. And by the way, if you want the complete references, please see me after class, after this. It's a career damage move after this session. What I can say, however, is if you find this stuff interesting, please go out and buy and read Daniel Kahneman's book from November 2011 called Thinking Fast and Slow. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow. It is absolutely, completely brilliant. Kahneman, by the way, won the Nobel Prize in Behavioral Economics in 2004, I believe. And it's a great book, and you can read it over dinner, over evening time, even a weekend. I did it. It was brilliant. Furthermore, the work of Kahneman and Tversky influenced other people, people like Baruch Fischoff at Carnegie Mellon, one of my mentors, Paul Slovic in Oregon, and Sarah Lichtenstein, also based in Oregon. And what they found out here is that people view risks differently. One key factor is the whole issue of natural vis-a-vis technological. Natural hazards are seen to be what? To be seen to be acts of God. There is no one to blame. Technological hazards are seen to be acts of humans. There are someone to blame. When I was doing my PhD on the East Coast of the United States, I should clarify, I'm very Swedish, as you can see from my name, but I spent a lot of time in the States. You can probably hear it from my accent, actually, can't you? I think you probably can. And I was doing my PhD East Coast side of the United States. A lot of my undergraduate students decided to basically, to ditch class and say, "No, Ragnar, we're going to go away for a few days." I said, "Why?" "Oh, Ragnar, it's hurricane season, you know? Hurricanes are really cool. So what are you going to do? Oh, we're going to go down to the Florida Keys. And then we're going to basically rent a couple of flats in the Florida Keys. And we're going to buy a few bottles of rum. And we're going to do what? We're going to party the hurricane." And they had a great time partying the hurricane. And came back and described to me in great detail how drunk they were partying this hurricane. What do you think happened when we had the Three Mile Island accident in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania in 1979, when a local radio station said, "We've had a minor incident here at Three Mile Island. We suggest that all pregnant women within a radius of, say, 15 miles should evacuate now for safety precautions." What do you think happened? Obvious, right? They all evacuated. Everybody evacuated. So nobody evacuated because we couldn't move because the roads were gridlocked. Did anybody stay behind and say, "You know what? Let's go party Three Mile Island"? No, of course not. So some people actively go out and seek natural hazards, but people will not go out and seek technological hazards. A big difference. Is this interesting, by the way? Enjoying us? Oh, phew. Thank you for inviting me. I was getting... We need to be sure about these things. I'm going to discuss Swedish foresters at the time, otherwise. Another important issue is Hosha voluntary vis-a-vis involuntary risk. Work by a man named Chauncey Starr showed in 1969 that people are 1,000 times more worried about involuntary risks than they are about voluntary ones. What happens here is many people like taking voluntary risks. How many of you are skiers? Okay, and why do you guys go skiing for? Because it's fun, right? You like that, like the risk element. It's like being outdoors, seeing the snow, beautiful people, beautiful sights, right? Not sure? More or less, yeah? But do you worry about the risks of skiing? Oh, another person up here says, kind of, yes. So what do you think is the risk of skiing if you're skiing in Zermatt, Switzerland, you're a non-Swiss, and you ski less than 10 days a year? Can we have a guess of percentages? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 20, 50, 100. Any guesses? I'm not grading you, by the way. 10. 10, we have 10 up front. Higher or lower? Higher. Somebody says lower. Okay, fair enough. The reason why I ask you this, because now you can see it, now you can hear an anecdotal story. I was very much skiing, pleasurably down a very simply blue run in Zermatt, Switzerland back in 2005. And lo and behold, my binding released. Not a good thing. Involuntarily binding released. I flew up in there, and I landed basically 100 kilos in my right leg. I broke my leg in four places, something you don't want to do. I'm never going to go for childbirth, my friends, but you know what? I think I probably did that with breaking my leg in four places. I did scream. It was very, very painful. Anyways, after I broke my leg and realized that's it, my skiing holiday is over on day three, I was taken down an ambulance to the local hospital in a place called Visp, where they very kindly operated me on. I didn't have my laptop or my BlackBerry with me, so I was kind of stuck. And I don't really like watching television that much. You know, I like to think, you know. So I decided to figure out, you know, how many folks are in this hospital this week? How many of them basically have broken bones? Where are you from? How many people actually are based in Zermatt skiing this week? So I did a minor, you know, back of the envelope calculation. And we found out basically every single person in that hospital that week were, hello, non-Swiss. They were all basically Flatlanders. They were Dutch, they were Danes, they were Brits, they were Irish, and occasional, you know, token southern Swedish guy like myself tossed in there. We were basically a complete sausage factory of going into operation room and coming back out again. And we calculated basically that the risk of breaking a leg there in Zermatt, breaking a bone, not just a leg, a bone, fingers included, was 2.4%. Now, don't quote Lofsted on this because it's anecdotal back-of-the-envelope calculation. But since I'm 48 now, it's basically in my mid-40s then. I'd skied half my life. If you do an ad hoc risk analysis, which, by the way, you should never do, but you can do it anyways, so 22 years times 2.4% is around 50%. I was waiting to break my leg, wasn't I? That's what happened. And now you're going to ask me, why I go skiing again? Well, I have been once or twice, but you know what? It's not the same thing anymore. Once you break a leg, you know, you kind of lose enjoyment of it. But what's happening here is that when we take voluntary risk, we make our own independent, personal, basically, benefit risk calculation. We think, basically, for me personally, the risks of skiing, basically, are small, and the benefits are great. Therefore, I'll continue to go skiing. The same thing, for example, classic example is the whole issue of mobile telephones. A lot of people have small worries of mobile telephones, but all of you still have a mobile telephone or a smartphone or something because you think the benefits outweigh the risks. Furthermore, in that same area of mobile telephony, People worry a lot about mobile telephone base stations. People hate these base stations. They think they're worried about the value of the home going down, but they also worry about this, you know, radiation from this base station going in and creeping into their bedroom and nuking their kids, right? But in actual fact, the radiation from these base stations are much less than they are in your phone. But your phone, hello, is a voluntary risk, and that base station is certainly not voluntary. It's highly involuntary. Another important factor is the whole issue of familiar vis-a-vis non-familiar risk. Is this pace okay? Is pace good? Good. Let me know if I go too fast. You'll stop me, or yes, you just tell me, Ragnar, you're speaking too fast. Familiar vis-a-vis non-familiar risk. People are afraid of the unknown, right? Horrified of the unknown. Familiar risk, we accept much more. If you look, for example, back at the various flu outbreaks we've had in this country and elsewhere in Europe and North America, and look how basically these flu outbreaks have been seriously hyped and discussed. You know, you speak to the medical authorities in this country, they are worried about one issue, the repeat of the Spanish flu. And the reason what happened to Spanish flu, as you all know, because you've been teaching this topic everywhere, is basically it affected younger kids, younger people, more than old ones. Every single year, you have ordinary flu, and a few people die. Most of them are old people. Old people are supposed to die. Young people are not supposed to die. And that's what people worry about, this whole issue of Spanish flu. Do you think the whole issue of these flus have been well handled? Have they been well handled by the various regulators? I would say basically overall, and I should clarify conflict of interest, I have basically advised regulators in this country, in Brussels, Sweden, and elsewhere. I find many cases, they have actually been pretty badly handled. They have frightened people in many ways, it's unnecessarily. I'm going to give you one example. During the bird flu outbreak we had a few years ago, I had been spending the day advising a friend at DG Sanco. I should clarify, I travel every week, give a talk somewhere in Europe and North America, more or less every week. I was in Brussels talking to the consumer affairs folks about bird flu and communicating bird flu. I came home that evening. I'm married. I have two daughters, live by the tennis courts in Wimbledon. And my oldest daughter was crying in bed. My wife said, you know, Ragnar, go upstairs and see what's going on. So I dash upstairs, and there she is wailing her eyes out. And she says, Papa, I'm worried about dying, she says. I said, oh, no. It's starting earlier and earlier and earlier. You know, it's just kind of ridiculous. And I said, so, sweetheart, why are you worried about dying? And I said, well, I'm worried about dying for bird flu, she says. So why are you worried about dying from bird flu, sweetheart? What's going on? Papa, I have a bird turd on my window, she says. And she points at the window up top floor of the house. And I said, you know, sweetheart. And I picked on a country. No offense on the country I picked on. Say somewhere in Southeast Asia. I'll say Vietnam for argument's sake. So I said, basically, sweetheart, you have nothing to worry about. If you were basically living in Vietnam and you were sleeping here with 3,000 ducks for a period of 6 months, you maybe get bird flu. But you won't get bird flu here in SW19 in Wimbledon. And she said, you know how girls are, she would just look at, you know, all kids are, they look at you and they point and say, Papa, are you sure? And I say, sweetheart, I'm a risk professor. I'm positive. And so you guys like that one. That's good. So what happens then is like, I think, what on earth is going on here? My daughter is freaking out over bird flu. So I need to know what's going on. So I go downstairs and I inquire, and it turns out that the children's BBC program, they had the news thing. And basically, if I'm not going to mention anybody's name, we'll just call them Fruitcake, said something basically on television. Not a question of if, but when we'll have a certain number. I believe it was 50,000 people dead from bird flu. Remember that? People remember that, right? I say, wow, that's a pretty big number. Where's this coming from? So I decide, firstly, to make a few phone calls. So I called the local GPs and my area in SW18 and asked them, has anybody called to you? I introduced who I am. You know, I'm a professor of risk communication and risk management at King's College. Has anybody called about bird flu? And he said, oh, it's been horrible. The phone has been inundating. We've been every single minute of the day. People are calling us bird flu. So who's calling? Old age pensioners. So, what are they saying? Oh, they're saying three things, professor. They're saying basically, can I have Tamiflu? That's this, you know, anti-flu thing you get from some company. B, basically, can I have vaccination against bird flu? And then C, you guessed it, I have bird flu. So there you go. At this note, I realized something is pretty seriously going on here, so I make a phone call to the UK government and demand to speak to Sir Howell James. Sir Howell James, at the time, was the head of communication for the UK government based in the Cabinet Office. So I insist on seeing you, I said. I used all my titles and dropped every single name I possibly could on the planet. And so you need to see me because this is just horrible. And for some bizarre reason, he does see me on the same day. So I go in there. And you know how it is when you're a parent and you're on a mission here because your daughter has been upset about something? You want to clear this mess up. So basically, so I go there. I go in there. And I say, basically, and you know how it is when you go into the interview room and you see very negative body language, right? And these people, like, you know, crossing their arms and they're staring at you and they're just, like, you know, think you're riffraff. And you say, just go over there and just sit down there kind of thing. That's like me. So I sat down there with my little trusty rucksack. And they said, basically, so, Professor, you have a problem with our bird flu strategy? I said, yes, I have a very big problem with your bird strategy, communication strategy. I said, are you completely insane, I say. Why on earth are you preaching 50,000 people dead? It was if but one. You said 50,000 people dead. You have absolutely zero evidence for that, I said. What you should have said, and the public of this country are not stupid, and they deserve better than you being frightening the daylights out of them. What you should have said, we don't know how many people die of bird flu. We simply don't know. It could be zero people, or based on WHO extrapolations, it could be 750,000 people. We simply don't know. And then I told Sir Howell, just after that, is we'll now assemble an expert panel of people who are working in an area of, you know, flu epidemics, and they will be meeting once a week until we have more clarity. And then we'll communicate to you what we think the risks are dying of bird flu. By saying, basically, putting this number out of the air, you know, from this WHO estimates, 50,000 people dead, you're doing the public of this country a disservice, and you're frightening unnecessarily based on no evidence. I said, the public deserve better, and if you give them, basically, tell them we have scientific uncertainty now, and we'll have scientific certainty at some stage, the publics will buy into that. And they said to me, wow. Are you sure, Professor? Since I've been active in this field since Chernobyl accident in 1986, I know more about communication than you do. Just implement what I have to say, and I just walk out the door. And I was just, you know, stupid question, fruitcake, you know. So anyways, that fruitcake was not on television anymore. It didn't frighten the publics anymore. And that was the end of the story. How many people died of bird flu in the UK? Does anybody know? Zero. Not one. It killed a few turkeys, mind you, up here in Norfolk somewhere. But it didn't kill any birds. It didn't kill any people, I can assure you. So it's really important. We can communicate scientific uncertainty. And I think what I don't like when I go into meetings, I'm not going to, this is on the record, so I won't say anything more than that. But I go into meetings and individuals say, oh, the publics are stupid. The publics are not stupid. They're basically being informed by sometimes a bad communication environment, sometimes by people in government themselves, but also sometimes by the media, in particular Daily Mail, who I simply cannot stand. And, you know, it's nice being an academic. I can say these things, you know. I can say anything I want to. I love being an academic. It's a lot of freedom here. So very important, familiar vis-a-vis non-familiar risk. Another important factor is the whole issue of control vis-a-vis non-control. We want to be in control at all times. That's one reason why, for example, we are more terrified of flying than driving. Why? Because when you're driving, you have control of the car, and when you're flying, you're giving that control to a pilot. A pilot you have never even met before. How many of you think you're good drivers? Hands up. It's getting better. 74% of you, according to research Professor Ola Svensson of Stockholm University, think you're good drivers. It's basically the fruitcake in front of you is going too slow. That's why you bumped into them. And what happens is basically also when you're driving with your loved one, sometimes you have a quarrel because you want to drive the car. And when you don't drive the car, you become a backseat driver. You say you're going too fast, you're going too slow. Why are you brake now, indicate stop. Because you want to drive that car because you trust yourself more in driving that car than you trust your loved one in driving that car. Control is very important. Further factor is the whole issue of high-frequency, low-consequence risk vis-a-vis low-frequency, high-consequence risk. People worry much more about low-frequency, high-consequence risks. We worry about kill sizes. So, I mean, a classic example here is comparing airplane accidents with car accidents. Car accidents, in my view, are a high-frequency, low-consequence risk. Usually it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people dying rather than 200 people dying, unless you have a massive car, you know, pile-up that it had last November at the fireworks down in Devon somewhere. And what happens is basically these types of risks, the high-frequency, low-consequence ones, are not communicated by the media. Therefore, if you go home tonight from here from Cambridge in a car and you basically get killed in a car accident, my friends, you will not make the media tomorrow morning. Unless you're Princess Diana, should make the media, but not you. However, a low-frequency, high-consequence risk is something that the media likes reporting about, the kill size factor. And what happens is if you have an accident here at Heathrow tonight when you're flying back to Dublin or wherever you're going to fly back to, and that plane explodes and you have 400 people dead, what's going to happen? I can guarantee you, positive, that'll be the first thing on BBC News tonight at 10 o'clock. Anybody bet against me? No, I'm absolutely positive. It will be also the main thing in the broadsheets tomorrow morning. The first 4 pages, there'll be these pictures of this plane blowing up, you know, body parts strewn everywhere, okay? That's day one. Day two, basically, out of those 400 people dead, how many Brits were among those 4 people dead, okay? We're in the UK. We don't care about us Swedes, right? We're completely insignificant in this category. Or the Americans or Germans or something. We care about Brits, okay? So they say basically it's 200 Brits dead. Day four, then they care about basically the women and the kids. Us middle-aged men were basically dead anyways. So basically how many basically were kids and women? Oh, basically were 50 girls and basically 120 women or something like that. And then finally, day 7, cause of accident, too much fine wine, bought basically in Heathrow duty-free. That's basically how media reports airplane accidents. And the result is that people are so much more worried about airplanes than they are about cars. I gave a talk at a Federal Aviation Authority in Washington, D.C. a few months ago. And I was giving a version of this talk. And I was asking the FAA, basically, what do you think would happen, how many people die in car accidents in the United States every year? Does anybody know? Trivial pursuit question. Usually about 35,000 plus or minus 5,000 individuals. Last year was 32,978 approximately. So basically, I asked them, so what happens if we had 35,000 people dying in an airplane accident, in airplanes every year in the United States? And a guy looked at me in horror and said, Professor, that's a serious question. And so, I'm just hypothesizing. So we academics do. We hypothesize. What do you think would happen? So that professor, you know what would happen. So I'm just asking, please tell me. We would close down airspace. So I said basically, so you are accepting 35,000 people dead on the roads, but you aren't accepting 35,000 people dead in airplanes. Is it? That's right. And a lot of the main reasons for that is the media. The media basically frighten people from flying, but road accidents happens all the time, so we can accept those deaths. It's something to think about, isn't it? And what's interesting, by the way, on that point, I usually get this question, so obviously I'll answer it before you give it to me. So it's basically, are airplanes always safer than cars? And on a 24-hour, 7-day cycle, there's only one period where cars are safer than airplanes. That's Sunday morning between 7 and 9 a.m. when the women are driving, or men are driving to church. Rest of the 24, 7-day cycle, airplanes are safer. The second question I usually get asked, so professor, in terms of when are cars most dangerous? 2 periods. It's basically Friday nights and Saturday nights between midnight and 4 in the morning when people come back drunk or to have too much, drugs or whatever they've been doing, or lack of sleep. Furthermore, another final factor here is the whole issue of female vis-a-vis male. Women are much more worried about risks than men. And there are 2 explanations for that. One is the very vulgar Stone Age explanation, which I do not buy into, by the way, but I'll give it to you anyways. It's basically women are basically home nurturing and men are out hunter-gathering. It's very simplistic and I don't buy into it. But more seriously, research by Professor Jen Lerner at Harvard shows that women overall much more emotional than men, and there's a clear connection between emotion and risk aversion. So when these variables were basically introduced in the 1960s and 70s up to the early 80s, regulators and industry took the view that one should develop risk communication programs. They were saying, wow, what a fascinating, interesting work from all these psychologists, been primarily active in the United States, by the way, you know, putting forward all these recommendations. We can now develop communication programs, and we can convince the publics of Europe and North America on how to build nuclear power plants and how to site nuclear waste facilitators and basically convince publics that certain foods are safe. This is great. We now know why you guys think this risk is higher than another one, because it's an involuntary risk, it's an unfamiliar risk, or it's non-controllable, and the like. So they put forward three types of communication strategies, that of top-down, dialogue, or bottom-up. The first one is top-down, is basically, that is, I stand on a podium, I'm trying to convince you that we should build basically a fourth or third or a fourth runway at Heathrow, and I'm saying basically, the reason why we should have this runway in Heathrow is this, and I know it's involuntary for you and it's unfamiliar for you, but I want to persuade you anyways. Top-down risk communication strategies usually don't work. The second form strategy is so-called dialogue strategy. Rather than being basically up here on a podium, I'll basically be sitting basically in the audience. Clarify, these will be available, these PowerPoint slides, right? So you don't have to copy all the slides if you don't want to. So what happens here, basically, I'll be in the audience with you, so I'm going to be sitting down and saying, basically, let's build this waste incinerator. So I'm not going to leave the camera, otherwise I would have done that. Walk down here, and I sit down there with you, right in the front seat here. So let's build this waste incinerator. I know you don't really like it, but how about make some kind of compromise? You know, let's find a deal. So how about if I move your ancestral burial ground from place A to place D? Will you then buy into a waste incinerator? Or possibly if I basically add some little playground for your kids in the back over there, nicely landscaping, you know, fresh grass and the like. Can we find some solution? Dialogue risk communication can work if you, A, trust me, B, basically feel that all these gifts are not bribes, but they are basically more than not bribes, but something more serious that you really are actually really concerned about my ancestors, and C, that I feel empowered to tell you if I don't like this, you can get lost. So dialogue can work. The third example of risk communication is so-called bottom-up risk communication. What happens here is something starts at a local level and then moves up to a national level, and then it goes international. And a classic point is the Greenpeace's occupation of the Brent Spar oil storage buoy in the mid-1990s, as you know, in the North Sea, where this issue became very much of a, firstly, a local issue, but very quickly was scaled up to an international issue because Greenpeace, very smartly, it tried to put on this vessel campaigners who were fluent in German, Dutch, Danish, Norwegian, as well as English, so they could get multiple news outlets and became very much of an international European issue. So you figured risk communication is still very difficult to do. And there are a number of reasons for that. And what happened was, the individuals who were trying to build waste incinerators and nuclear power plants. And once again, I should clarify that historically, up in the past 20, 15 years, is that something like 90% of all research in this topic has been done in the United States. This is not changing over time. So what happened was they said, we can still build this nuclear power plants. We have all the tools you've given us, and we still can't build them. And people still don't love us, you know. It's a horrible thing, you know. Can you please find out why people don't love us? What's going on? Have we failed? So we all sat down and we got back involved with this and identified a number of key variables. First point is the whole issue of the social amplification and the social attenuation of risk. Some risks are socially amplified and some risks are socially attenuated, exact opposite to amplification. If I mentioned, for example, airplane accidents are highly amplified by the media and by social networks and by all of us. Other risks are attenuated. For example, in the U.S., suicides are attenuated. In the U.S., you have basically a deal. The media has a deal They do not report on suicides. And the reason for that is they're worried about so-called copycat suicides. The most favorite place to kill yourself in the United States is where? Does anybody know? Very good. You guys are on the ball. And what is late in the day? Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. So basically, people kill themselves all the time over there. And what happens, basically, if you had a San Francisco Chronicle have an article about, you know, Joe Bloggs jumps off bridge, Golden Gate Bridge, what would happen on day two? You have four Joe Bloggs. And then week, and then day seven, you have 20. And then the month later, we have 50, a group jump all off the Golden Gate Bridge. We don't really want that, do we? So we tend to attenuate suicides. And on that note, can you please tell your journalist friends in this country that they should please, please, please also attenuate suicides? The reason why I say that, and I should clarify my personal interest, I'm married, I have two teenage daughters. This is something that worries me a lot. I remember we had in South Wales a few years ago. Wasn't it absolutely horrific? The media was partially responsible for those girls' deaths. You had basically teenage girls in South Wales hanging themselves in their bedrooms. That should not have been reported. By reporting it, people were saying, okay, fine, topping yourself is normal, let's do it myself. We did not want suicides amplified. We want suicides attenuated. Please, please, please. And the same thing goes, in my view, in terms of multiple murders in schools, where kids come in with machine guns and guns and kill everybody, you know, Columbine, for example. These issues should also not be amplified. We should attenuate them as much as possible, because by amplifying, that gives kids, other kids, ideas. That explains partially, for example, why we had now a couple of mass murders in schools in Finland. Why? Because they've been amplified by the media. This is very worrying. It's something I do hope. Please tell your journalist friends, don't amplify suicides. Another issue to attenuate is so-called basically taboo risks. Depression is basically something that is attenuated. You don't discuss depression, because depression is seen not to be normal. And furthermore, sexually transmitted diseases are also attenuated. For example, if I had gonorrhea, would I tell you about it? Would I? No, of course not. And reason for, I don't have gonorrhea, trust me. So, of course not. Why would I not tell you about if I had gonorrhea or not? Because if I had it and I told you, my credibility in your eyes would go down the toilet, wouldn't it? But I already told you, I'm happily married, I have two daughters, live in Wimbledon. So you think, why on earth did he get gonorrhea from? Where's this man been? Somewhere in Amsterdam or something? What an idiot, you know. He's hanging out with prostitutes? What's he doing? You know, this is not normal. You would think much less of me. That said, what I try to tell my students at King's College, I don't know how it is, at least up here in this part of the world, woods, is I want to have kids to be aware of STDs, and also go and have themselves checked. Because it's very clear, particularly chlamydia at universities in this country is on the rise. And it's something that we should actually amplify. That should tell you, journalists, don't amplify suicides. Amplify chlamydia. So people get worried about chlamydia and get themselves checked out, please. So one crucial importance was the issue of social amplification as well as attenuation of risk. Another variable that came up was the whole issue of the so-called narrative approach. One of the main factors why risk communication has failed, is now by the early 1990s, is that people communicated in numbers. People don't understand numbers. 50% of Americans cannot tip in restaurants. They don't understand tipping. They don't understand, you know, if I want to leave 10%, how much money is that, you know, on a tip? And even if you go to New York, you have to tip. Otherwise, you get shot, more or less. Furthermore, 25% of university-educated Americans do not know the difference between 1%, 5%, or 10% in terms of risk. What's higher, what's lower? People do not like numbers. So one of the main failures of risk communication prior to the 1990s was people were communicating in numbers. They were saying, this risk is small. It's like 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, or 10 to the minus 9. People didn't know the difference between 10 to the minus 4, 5, and 9. That was a crucial failure. But we found in the risk community in the 90s and just the past 15 years or so was that the best way actually of phrasing risk communication messages is via narratives and anecdotes, stories. People like stories. I'm convinced that after you had a glass of wine tonight, you remember two things from my talk today. That is basically the professor breaking his leg in four places in Zermatt, and my daughter and the bird poo example. Am I right? Yeah, because those are anecdotal, personal stories, and they're both true, by the way. People ask me, does that really happen to you? I can show you if you want to. I can show you I still have bolts in my right leg, by the way. And the story of my daughter is absolutely positively true, too. Believe me on that. Is people like stories. The problem is, and I always give this talk to regulators, is that when you go into narratives and you go into stories, please compare like with like. Apples with apples and oranges, and not apples and oranges. I find this profoundly irritating when people don't do that. I mean, for example, one typical example, basically, it's like being walking around in a thunderstorm and being hit by lightning. The risk is really small. You heard it before? Yes. Okay? Well, my friends, it really depends where you are in a thunderstorm, doesn't it? So, for example, if you are here down in College, Cambridge, now in a thunderstorm, you know what? We are perfectly safe here. We're not going to be struck by lightning, I can guarantee you, right? Yes, thank you very much. However, if you are basically fishing in a small little rowboat in a South Swedish lake with your two daughters, and all of a sudden you have a lightning storm, thunderstorm hitting you, you know what? The chances of being hit by lightning is pretty high. That's what happened to me last summer. And that was a horrifying experience. I have never rowed so fast in my entire life. I was going, please don't die, let's just make it, let's make it. You know, and the thunder was almost just, is he counting? Boom, he's here. It was a horrible thing. And I gave a talk actually just a couple months ago to U.S. Coast Guard, as you do. And I asked them basically, so what should I have done when you are in a boat in a thunderstorm like that? Well, Professor, you were more or less toast. If that lightning were to hit you. I said, thank you very much. That wasn't very helpful. Well, you were toast. You don't go out in thunderstorms fishing in a rowboat. That was stupid. So, you know how Coast Guard, these military folks can be quite direct, actually. So they weren't. So keep that in mind. Don't go out fishing in thunderstorms. So compare like with like. Another example is basically living next to a nuclear power station is like smoking one cigarette in your lifetime. That's a horrible example. Why? Because living next to a nuclear power station, example of what? Of an involuntary risk, which we discussed before, people are 1,000 times more worried about. Smoking a cigarette is what? A voluntary risk. That's not like with like. So if you're going to go for anecdotes now with your students and teachers and so on and so forth, please do apples with apples. Another whole issue is issue of deliberation, and I have 6 more minutes and I'm going to finish up. Deliberation is, and I'm slides 8. That's more than last week in Bonn. Okay, get one more and we'll stop. So the whole importance of deliberation is that there's a belief that we should involve the public much more in the policy-making process. You know what? I'm all for that. But the problem in doing so, and it's something we have to have the policymakers and regulators work on much harder, the problem to do so is a so-called self-selection process. So, for example, a few years ago, I did a major study trying to involve a number of Germans in the North Black Forest in trying to help site a waste incinerator. What we wanted them to do is to participate once a week for 2 hours from 7 to 9 in the evening on a Wednesday for a period of 6 months to get enough knowledge on the whole siting of the waste incinerator issue we go and basically have them come up with the decision. And we're going to pay them basically something like 800 Deutschmarks, 400 euros for the process. So of the 4,500 letters we sent out to random households in North Black Forest, how many of those individuals decided to participate? Want to guess?
Zero.
Anybody else? 5%. It was 3.5%. It was basically around 200 individuals. And those 200 individuals had three things in common. I'm going to count them up for you. Do you think they were for or against incinerator? Thank you. It's just getting good. Against incinerator, okay? Did they have basically time on their hands or were they time poor? They had time on their hands. They were pensioners, hello. They were students, or basically they were housemen or housewives, or they were unemployed. And a third factor, were they more right of spectrum politically or more left of spectrum politically? They were more left spectrum. They were either social democrats or they were greens. And the state of Baden-Württemberg until the last election was a CDU conservative stronghold and with low unemployment. Something to keep in mind. This is something that we need to consider. And we have less than 5 minutes. We won't go through 8 slides then. Another important factor is how you should have optimistically biased. Work by Neil Weinstein found out, basically, that we are, in many cases, very much optimistically biased. That is, for example, particularly when you're young. That's why people smoke or people drink. Smokers, when they start smoking 15, 16, or 17 years of age, they think, A, that they're not going to be killed of smoking. They can, and B, they feel they can stop smoking at any time. That's not a big deal. I'm 17, I have a great body, I'm beautiful, I can stop smoking anytime I want to. And research shows, of course, basically, that most individuals cannot stop smoking once they've started. Similar to people who are alcoholics and they drink a bottle of whiskey a day, whatever they do, they don't think they'll get closer to their liver, do they? No, but Joe Bloggs down here down in College, Cambridge, this individual has basically a bottle of whiskey and he drinks it. He will die from closer to the liver, but not me. We are optimistically biased. However, with age, we get wiser and we become more aware of the risks. For example, now I'm much more aware of skiing, this risk of skiing, than I ever was before. And furthermore, if people feel good about an activity, they see the risk as relatively low. And likewise, if people feel bad about an activity, they see its risk as relatively high. And a final factor is the importance of trust. Trust can explain up to how 50% of how the public perceive risks. So, for example, if you trust a risk imposer, if you believe an individual is in the right place morally, he seems to be very sympathetic, and I can buy into what he's saying, you're willing to accept a much higher risk from that risk imposer than if you thought the risk imposer was a complete and utter liar. It happens again and again. And that's one of the problems, for example, for industry in many parts of Europe and North America, is the public simply don't believe what they're doing. And as a result, they're willing to accept a very, very little risk. So, and now we have 2 minutes. So basically, now I'm going to discuss, those are the variables of risk perception and communication. Now I'm going to discuss basically some of the next steps. What should happen next from the Ragnar perspective? And something I've been thinking about for quite a while now since I've been advising government. Firstly, in my view, we need to introduce a broader discussion on risk. I feel it should be both at the school level as also on the government level. I have been living in this country since 1993. How many talks have I given at schools, you think, since I've come to this country? Two. One in 1997 to a Catholic schoolgirl somewhere in South London, and just a few months ago to my daughter's school. Two of them. I think basically that the schools of this country should use us risk professors much more so and have us, not saying that every single week, give me ideas now, maybe once a year to discuss the importance of risk perception and communication at schools at some kind of lunch seminar. I think that would be a very good thing to do. Furthermore, I feel we should have a much broader discussion of risk also at a government level. And on that point, I can tell you there is a meeting on a cross Whitehall meeting on risk next November that will be led by the chief scientist, John Beddington. We also need a more sophisticated discussion about risk in the media. I mentioned the Daily Mail effect, how much I hate that. And I think maybe some form of media guidelines are needed, like the BBC that came out in 2003. We should have a more broader discussion on risk-based policymaking on the EU level. On that note, I can tell you the European Parliament, under Julie Gerling, Conservative MEP, is setting up a working group on risk going forwards right now. We met actually last month. We need also to ensure that we discussed in the last panel the issue of transparency. I heard that word a lot, actually, in the last panel. And transparency is here to stay. We have more and more transparency now thanks to internet and social media and the like. But in my view, I don't know how it is in the school system, but I think many stakeholders are simply not ready for it. This is dangerous. When stakeholders are not ready for it, is what's going to happen, then that will lead to greater distrust. Transparency, my friends, is like toothpaste. Once it's out of a tube, you won't put it back in again. And then you're going to be stuffed. And finally, and of course, as a plea, we need more funding for higher education in the area of risk-based policymaking. I should clarify, I'm biased here. But I think this is something... I admit that. But I think something... I mean, this is an important area, and it's something we can do much more in the future. On that note, I say thank you very much for your attention.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.